From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, we're devoting our entire show to politics. Seriously, because earlier this year, a Supreme Court decision reversed campaign finance rules in place for decades, opening the tap on undisclosed campaign contributions, which in turn flood the zone with advertising like never before. Much more on that coming up. This campaign season, spending on political broadcast ads has exceeded $1 billion, $250 million of which was spent in the last 2 weeks alone. Is it really worth it? This hour, we'll consider how that money talks and how far we've come, or haven't, in a half century of television campaign ads.
The bedrock belief in modern politics is that money corrupts. The axiom plays out from sea to shining sea, or from Michael Bloomberg to Arnold Schwarzenegger. We seem to like the idea, the elegant simplicity of the notion that money buys elections.
I will tell you this, Brooke. If you go on the air, as you're doing here, and tell people that campaign spending matters much, 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 much less in electoral outcomes than they think, people will hate you for it.
Stephen Dubner is a journalist, co-author of Freakonomics, and host of the popular Freakonomics podcast. You have written about some research that your partner in crime, Stephen Levitt, did back in 1994. Can you tell me about his methodology?
This was back when he was in graduate school, and as an economist in training, he was doing a little bit of futzing around in the political science realm. And because he was manually typing in from the Congressional Record the names of candidates who ran against each other in years and years and years of congressional races, he began to notice a pattern, which was that there were quite a few instances in which the two same candidates ran against each other repeatedly. And what Levitt found was that if you looked at the congressional races where the same two candidates ran against each other repeatedly, well, the appeal of the candidate presumably didn't change a whole lot. You'd have to control for incumbency and things like that. But what often did change was the amount of money that was spent. And what that allowed him to do was to try to isolate the causal effect of the money itself. How important is it to spend a lot more money? And the result was, I'll be honest with you, I found it to be rather shocking. You can double the amount you spend and raise your share of the vote by about 1%. Similarly, if you're winning an election and you cut your spending in half, you'll lose only about 1% of the vote.
Okay, but Stephen Levitt drew a lot of his conclusions from a study done back in the mid-90s. Hasn't the growing amount of campaign cash and now the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which opens the floodgates even more, doesn't that make a difference?
I would say two things about it. First of all, even though Levitt's first study in this was several years back, similar studies and replications have been done since. And the findings are quite consistent. Also, even though the total this year for all congressional and Senate races will be in the neighborhood of about $2 billion, it sounds like so much, but compared to what? I mean, compared to GDP, even compared to how much Americans spend on, I don't know, chewing gum, aluminum foil, iTunes downloads in one day, 1 week, it's really a pitifully small amount if you think about it.
But compared to the rest of the world, it isn't.
No, compared to the rest of the world, isn't it? It's a good indicator of how rich a country we are that we can afford to flush $2 billion down the toilet every year trying to influence elections when it's almost inconsequential. Winning candidates do raise more money, but the relationship between the money and their winning, it's just a correlation. It's not causal. So imagine you go out onto the street and it's raining really hard and everybody's got an umbrella. And if you didn't know any better, you'd think, oh, man, those umbrellas are making it rain. If only those people would put away the umbrellas, the rain would stop, right? That's kind of the way people think about campaign spending and winning elections. The people who win do raise and spend more money, but the reason they have more money is because they're a more attractive candidate.
In a moment, we'll be hearing from political scientist Paul Friedman. He's researched the issue and concluded that the volume of ads in an election does have the power to sway a potentially decisive percentage of voters. Even if we can influence them a little, might that be enough in this 50-50 country of ours where an election can be decided on very slender margins? Maybe that $100 might make a difference.
It might. And, you know, my doing a rain dance might make it rain, too. Absolutely. And, you know, the more you believe it, the more you're going to see signs that it's true. And of course you're going to find political consultants. Of course you're going to find professors of political science, too. You're going to find candidates, every candidate. You're going to find campaign managers who tell you the money is key. What I'm telling you is that if you actually use data to examine this question, rather than polling, rather than the kind of received wisdom of political consultants and their kind of gut instinct, what the data show is that it's just not true. Does that not mean that there might be a particular ad campaign on TV that really, really works more than the average? Absolutely, that happens. And there are anomalies all the time. The problem is what we do with the media is we take anomalies and we report them because that's what news is. So you're going to read somewhere in the next week or so the story about how one great ad turned the tide in some race and someone who was trailing 51 to 49 roared back because of this TV ad and won 53%. First of all, it's very hard to isolate the effect of that TV ad. And second of all, even if it's true, that's one race out of how many? And the fact is that if you look over the long stretch, you just don't find a causal relationship between spending and electoral outcome.
Stephen, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Stephen Dubner is a journalist, co-author of Freakonomics, and new host of the Freakonomics podcast, which has made it into the top 10 on iTunes. We'll link to it, or you can find it at freakonomicsradio.com.
Dubner's is a minority opinion. The data speak differently to different researchers. University of Virginia political science professor Paul Friedman also believes that campaign ads don't change that many minds, but maybe they change just enough to make a difference. He's the co-author of Campaign Advertising and American Democracy, and he had long observed that political advertising was the whipping boy of American politics, so maligned, so loathed, so powerful. So he and four colleagues set out in 1998 to gauge the real power of the ads by examining a decade's worth of data. They looked at precisely where ads had been broadcast, in what races, to which audiences, and they cross-referenced that information with data from surveys asking how the ads affected the votes of viewers. What researchers found was that most voters are exposed to hundreds of TV ads during a campaign season. Voters in hotly contested districts could see thousands of ads. As to the impact of the advertising, well, what Friedman and his colleagues learned upends the conventional wisdom that campaign ads, especially negative ads, are so toxic that they actually suppress voter turnout.
What we found is that, in fact, election campaigns are a lot like fights on the schoolyard. Do kids run away and say, we don't want to participate, we feel depressed and alienated? No, people run over to see the action. And they begin asking questions. What are they fighting about? Maybe there's reason to expect that election campaigns are like schoolyard fights.
And in a nutshell, your conclusions?
When it comes to political information, most Americans are fairly ill-informed. And what ads do is to really serve as nutritional supplements. They're jam-packed in some cases with relevant information about the candidates, about the race, about the issues, coded in an emotional, easy-to-swallow wrapping.
The vast majority of the attack ads I've seen take nominal facts about legislative votes or personal history, and then they twist them into big lies. And I'm talking about Republicans and Democrats both. And the idea that these things motivate voters, to me, is terrifying. Nutritional supplements? Isn't it more like tar and nicotine?
Well, nutritional supplements in the sense that at the end of a campaign, voters who have seen more ads simply know more than voters who have seen fewer ads. Certainly, some ads are misleading. I don't think anybody's suggesting that advertising can be a substitute for a C-SPAN debate on a particular issue. We're not making policy scholars out of viewers because we bombard them with a bunch of 30-second ads. But the more ads a voter has seen during the course of an election campaign, the more likely he or she is to care about the outcome of the race and the more likely they are to actually vote on election day.
Can you quantify this?
There are many different factors that combine to shape whether or not an individual is going to turn out to vote on election day. Education is one of the most important factors. Partisanship and how strong an attachment to one of the political parties you feel. Whether or not you're contacted by a campaign, the more money you have, the more likely you are to vote. In comparison to all of these factors, television advertising has a relatively modest effect. We're talking about the margins. We're talking about increasing the probability of voter turnout by really less than 10 percentage points. Now, that's not huge, but it's not nothing. Many Senate races this cycle and many House races are going to be decided by very, very narrow margins. And so changing voter turnout by 2 percentage points or 3 percentage points can make or break an election outcome.
Well, I guess you've talked me down from the ledge to some degree, but my takeaway from all of this is that whoever gets elected from either party, the only thing we're absolutely sure of is that he or she has just participated in a schoolyard fight.
We're not simply at the mercy of the messages that campaigns and candidates put out for us. There's an important role for the media. There's an important role for academia. There's an important role for organizations like PolitiFact and FactCheck.org. There's a need to hold these candidates' feet to the fire. And that, I think, is an important part of the campaign advertising landscape.
So considering how marginal the effect is, what about another piece of conventional wisdom that says that he who has the most money and can purchase the most media tonnage is going to prevail?
One of Barack Obama's real advantages in 2008 was that he had much, much, much more money than John McCain to spend on television ads. And indeed, he did. He outbroadcast John McCain by a wide margin. But in the primaries, John McCain was out-advertised and outspent by Mitt Romney. And so it's certainly not always the case that he or she who has the most money wins. But all else equal, you don't want to lose an election by one vote with one extra dollar in your campaign coffer.
Paul, thank you very much.
Bob, it's my pleasure.
Paul Friedman is an associate professor in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia and co-author of Campaign Advertising and American Democracy.
Coming up, who's paying? They're not saying.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Until this year, it seemed as if we were inching toward campaign finance transparency. From the creation of the Federal Election Commission in 1975 through the McCain-Feingold Act in 2002, reformers slowly but surely scored victory after victory. Then, just before the 2008 primary elections, a conservative nonprofit group called Citizens United produced a 90-minute film called Hillary, the Movie, and sought to promote it on television and air it on video on demand.
First, a kind word about Hillary Clinton.
Looks good in a pantsuit.
Now, a movie about everything else. Hillary, the Movie, on DVD.
Citizens United lost when a lower court agreed with the Federal Election Commission that Hillary, the Movie, violated the McCain-Feingold ban on corporate money being used for electioneering. Then in January, the Supreme Court essentially gutted McCain-Feingold. Speaking for the majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote, quote, "If the First Amendment has any force, it prohibits Congress from fining or jailing citizens or associations of citizens from simply engaging in political speech." Among the dissenters was Justice John Paul Stevens, who called the decision, quote, "a rejection of the common sense of the American people." He added, "While American democracy is imperfect, few outside the majority of this court would have thought its flaws included a dearth of corporate money in politics."
Congress tried to pass something called the Disclose Act to replace a few restrictions and, at the very least, ensure that the identities of those paying for the coming flood of political ads would be known. Maryland Democrat Chris Von Hollen helped co-write the bill.
We believe voters have a right to know who is paying for the ads that they're watching, and this bill would require lots of disclosure. It also prohibits foreign-controlled corporations from spending any money to influence American political elections and prohibits large recipients of federal dollars, like major federal contractors or big banks that receive taxpayer monies under TARP, like AIG, from taking that money and recycling it back into political advertising.
But last month in the Senate, the Disclose Act failed. Ken Vogel, writer for Politico.com, says that prior to Citizens United, most donations went through organizations called 527s, which required disclosure of donor names. Citizens United changed everything.
At that point, these 501c4 groups, which are technically social welfare organizations whose primary purpose is not politics, they became the vehicle of choice, and they don't have to disclose where they got their contributions. So this allowed donors to give huge sums of money to these groups without any risk of having their name associated with these ads, without any risk of being targeted or retaliated against for their contributions. That clearly worries advocates of campaign finance reform because they say it takes us in a direction where we have no idea where the money in our politics is coming from.
Now, strictly speaking, these 501c4s that allow people to contribute anonymously, under the tax code, they're not supposed to apply more than 50% of their revenues towards political donations. How do they get around that?
Some of these ads, which seem to be expressly political to the lay viewer, the defenders would say, are in fact issue-based ads.
Well, let's listen to one of those advocacy ads that is not explicitly electioneering.
For centuries, Muslims built mosques where they won military victories. Now they want to build a mosque at Ground Zero, where Islamic terrorists killed 3,000 Americans. It's like the Japanese building at Pearl Harbor. The Muslim cleric building the mosque believes America was partly responsible for 9/11 and is raising millions overseas from secret donors. But incredibly, Bruce Braley supports building a mosque at Ground Zero. Tell Braley what you think.
Yeah, that sounded like an ordinary attack ad to me. Tell me why that's an issue advocacy ad.
Well, their defenders would say that this ad is educating viewers or listeners about a particular issue. Clearly, to the lay viewer or listener, that's going to sound like attacking an individual, but there is a legal argument to be made that this is, in fact, not an attack election ad.
I want to ask you about Karl Rove, because when he formed a PAC called American Crossroads, there was a lot of snickering in the liberal media about how little he was able to raise in donations over the course of the first 3 months. You know, it was in the hundreds of dollars.
Many of the big donors who they were approaching did not want their names splashed across the headlines as funding this group that was associated with Karl Rove and was airing ads attacking Democrats. So they set up a 501c4 group and went back to these same donors and said, now you have the option of giving to us without your donations and your identities ever being known. And at that point, the fundraising took off.
Now, for the moment, it seems as if Republican candidates and issues have been the beneficiary of these dramatic changes in federal campaign finance laws. But the Citizens United case also liberated labor unions, traditionally big Democratic supporters, to do essentially the same thing. Has the money been flowing from big labor as well?
Labor unions basically have a pool of money that they allocate for election-related expenses that comes from their members paying dues primarily. And that is really capped at a certain amount based upon how many members they have and how much they charge these members for dues. So it's not like they have a tremendous new stream of revenue to be able to support a new type of election strategy.
Now, if there's an imbalance in the amount of money flowing towards the Republicans versus the Democrats, some of it is the Democrats' own fault. The president of the United States made that bed, and now his party has to lie in it. Tell me exactly how.
Well, during the 2008 presidential election, then-candidate Obama urged big Democratic donors not to give to these types of outside groups. And, of course, he didn't need it. He raised $750 million from individual donations, many of them small individual donations. Now, however, Democrats could really use that money, but many Democratic donors are still sitting on the sidelines because they feel like it would look hypocritical for them, given that the president and top officials in the Democratic Party have singled out these types of donations as being a problem for our democracy.
Now, within about 5 minutes of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, there was talk of legislation in Congress that would at least force disclosure of the source of funds. Such a bill was floated in Congress. What happened to it?
Well, that bill actually passed the House and failed in the Senate twice. And this is a Senate that was controlled by Democrats, albeit not with a filibuster-proof majority. So the prospects of this bill passing again, if Republicans retake one or both chambers of Congress, are pretty bleak.
Okay, Ken, once again, thanks so much.
It was my pleasure, Bob.
Ken Vogel writes about money and politics for Politico.
Trying to discern the motives and affiliations of the groups inundating us with advertising can be nearly impossible. I mean, their names certainly don't tell us anything.
Patriot Majority PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Center for Individual Freedom is responsible for the content of this advertising.
American Future Fund paid for and is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Paid for by Common Sense Issues.
Freedom's Defense Fund is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Americans for Prosperity is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Wow, you gotta love them, don't you, Dave?
Some very creative names, indeed.
I'm speaking to Dave Leventhal now. He is the communications director and editor of the OpenSecrets.org blog, part of the Center for Responsive Politics, which has been hard at work tracking money in politics for over a quarter century. Dave, wouldn't you say that with the new campaign finance rules, it's a whole new ballgame?
It's not really a whole new ballgame. It's literally the Wild West of campaign finance systems. You have the opportunity, if you are an organization, to effectively spend as much money as you want without necessarily having to disclose who is funding you. We've seen already about 10 organizations that have spent more than $20 million. And if you're living in a district where you have a particularly competitive congressional or senatorial race, then you can expect to have not only a barrage of advertisements, but as the clips that you broadcast indicate, a lot of times these groups have names that are effectively meaningless.
So how have you altered your own investigative methods to suit this new, more opaque campaign finance framework?
One thing that we do literally on an hourly basis is track where they're spending their money. So even if we or anyone else can't get to the root of who truly is fueling their political efforts with cash, we can tell you where they're putting their money in the end game, what races, what candidates they're targeting. And we've seen a number of organizations that are spending already into the eight figures. And between now and Election Day, even with a few days left, we fully expect that there are going to be tens upon tens of millions of dollars more flowing into the various elections across the country.
But does that help you figure out who these organizations are?
It doesn't necessarily, if at all, help you find out who these organizations are. And there have been some comedy of error type journeys that people have gone on to try to figure out that ultimately some of these groups are just a couple of folks. Now, they may have names like Citizens for This or That, but really, they're just a couple of citizens, not a thousand or a million.
Give me an example.
Americans for Job Security. As of today, Americans for Job Security have spent about $9 million in advertisements and other independent expenditures across the country in very, very competitive races. We know this is a conservative organization, certainly, but we have really, at the end of the day, no idea who truly, in a dollars and cents fashion, is fueling their efforts.
Is there a particular group that's been so successfully anonymous that it just keeps you awake at night?
There are quite literally dozens of these organizations. I don't know if you can pick on one any more so than the other, because the playing field is level. All organizations of any political stripe can engage in this type of political activity. And if they are a not-for-profit group, they simply don't have to disclose their donors.
But do you have one that's your Sasquatch, your Loch Ness Monster, your great Yeti?
On the right, We would love to find out more about who is truly fueling the efforts of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, because they've simply spent so much money, and primarily this money has gone to benefit Republicans. And this is something that we absolutely would love to have more information about. On the left, we'd love to find out more information about the League of Conservation Voters. How many people are in their league? How many voters? Relative to the Chamber of Commerce, they're spending a modest amount, only about $4 million so far. But they've been particularly active in the endgame here. They're dropping five-figure sums in races in Missouri and Colorado and Virginia, New Hampshire, California, Arizona, and all benefiting Democrats.
Dave, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dave Leventhal is the Communications Director for the Center for Responsive Politics and the editor of OpenSecrets.org.
Is it really that hard to figure out who's behind a big political ad campaign? For instance, who are the people behind the Coalition to Protect Seniors, which produced this?
Gramps is sad. Obama cut $455 billion from his Medicare. The last time they cut Medicare funding plans, the market bailed and his benefits were cut. Even I know that's wrong. If your grandpa's on one of these plans, I suggest you tell him to protect himself and vote this November. I don't know what smells worse, my diaper or this new bill.
New York Times reporter Mike McIntyre decided to find the Coalition to Protect Seniors, not necessarily as a journalist would, but just as an ordinary citizen would, limiting his sleuthing tools to his phone and his computer.
The first stop that you would take nowadays would be the website for the group, and right away you discover that there's no names attached to it, there's no real meaningful contact information, no phone number. No explanation of how the group was formed or what their intentions are or who is behind it. You can email them. There's an email address, which I took advantage of and never got a response. The one other tidbit of information on there was an actual mailing address, which turned out to be a mailboxes, et cetera, store. So looking at the website, which is what you know the average person might do to begin this odyssey, gets you nowhere, which is pretty much what was intended, I believe.
You've got the website, you've got an email address, and a mail drop in Wilmington. Where do you go next? You Googled them, right?
Yeah, sure. That's one of the first things you would want to do. And you do that, and again, you really don't find anything. So then you're left having to take a little bit of a deeper scrub here of this outfit to the extent that public records are available. The paper trail's pretty thin. This group, however, does have one other type of a filing it has to do. They have to file records with the Federal Election Commission, which basically describe how much they're spending on these advertisements and where they're spending their money. And so looking at those, I was able to figure out, you know, there were a couple of names on there. One of them is a consulting firm in Florida that seemed to be related to the healthcare industry.
Probably just a coincidence.
Could be, yeah. So I called the number for this particular consulting firm. And what was interesting is the name of the firm is the Fenwick Group. And when I called the number, a fellow picked up the phone and said, K&M Insurance. And it turns out, you know, it's a health insurance agency. And I told him I was looking for the Fenwick Group, and he said, oh, that'll be, you know, you have to talk to so-and-so. And I did eventually reach him. I got him on the phone, and he didn't deny that he's the guy who was helping put these ads out there, but he said he was not a member of the coalition. And I asked him, could you get in touch with the coalition and have somebody call me back? And he said he would, and no one ever did. And that was really the end of the trail.
What is the state of the law to make it easier for us to follow the money?
There are two federal agencies that have sway over this issue. One of them is the Federal Election Commission. The only requirement they have in this area is that if you're one of these groups and you accept a donation which is intended to be used for a specific ad campaign, you know, close to an election, you're supposed to disclose the name of the donor. These groups pretend none of it's earmarked for specific things. And the Federal Elections Commission has really not taken a hard look at that. The other agency is the Internal Revenue Service, and they really are the ones that I think are in the best position at this point to impose some sort of standards on many of the nonprofit groups that we're talking about. Because these groups, you know, in exchange for getting the benefit of not having to pay taxes on their revenue, they're supposed to abide by certain rules. One of them is that you can't spend a majority of your time engaging in political activity, and some of these groups seem to do nothing but that. You know, if the IRS chose to take a hard look at just what some of these groups are up to, they could at least make a case that some of these groups are in violation of tax laws.
If you are an interest group and you are noble of purpose, why would you have to pretend to be something you're not and to spend money under the guise of some disinterested party?
You know, many large donors are concerned about a backlash against them. The Chamber of Commerce, for instance, which has collected tens of millions of dollars anonymously from its members for ad campaigns, they point to instances during the healthcare debate in which they say some of their donors, when the names came out, were accosted at the homes of their CEOs, and there were protests outside their companies, and they were the victims of orchestrated campaigns online to smear them. They argue that free speech doesn't necessarily have to come with a name attached.
The Citizens United ruling by the Supreme Court, does that have any influence on the marketplace that we're discussing now?
It certainly has emboldened many groups that have been doing this all along. It essentially, you know, allows corporations to do not just issue ads, but for the first time expressly advocate for the election or defeat of a specific candidate, which is something they couldn't do in the past. What's interesting about that ruling, though, is that the majority of the Supreme Court in passing down this ruling seemed to feel that there already was proper disclosure requirements in place. And they suggest that that's a good idea. But it's interesting because when you really read the comments of the majority opinion, they seem to believe mistakenly that there already are provisions in place to allow for the identity of donors, and there's not.
All right, Mike. Well, for me and for all of us here at the Coalition for Media Nirvana, thanks so much for joining us.
Can I join?
You got to find us first. Mike McIntyre is a reporter for the New York Times.
Coming up, political slurs, why we make them, why we export them, and why we embrace them.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
There are no strings on me.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Why do even the most brazenly scurrilous and toxic ads so often beguile the electorate? Is it due to the skill of the messenger? Or the avidity of the messagee? In the months before the 2008 presidential election, a certain devilish question was making its way around the internet and into the mainstream media.
Is Obama the Antichrist? 73% of the site's online polls say either yes or maybe.
He literally could be a cosmic Antichrist figure.
Obama Antichrist internet traffic is up.
But it turns out that the political operatives and propagandists may be only partly to blame for the popularity of those rumors. Shankar Vedantam, author of the Hidden Brain column in Slate, says several recent studies are shedding light on the role we ourselves play in shaping political slurs. Shankar, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Brooke.
So let's start with the study involving this Obama as Antichrist meme.
Sure. So this was research done by Tom Pazinski, a social psychologist. He asked volunteers to come in and told them that he was giving them a creative writing exercise and asked them to write essays about people who were named either Brad Walker or Tyrone Walker. This has turned out to be a very effective way to prime people's unconscious racial attitudes, because Brad Walker is a typically white name and Tyrone Walker is a typically black name. And then Pazinski presented his volunteers with a number of statements about the 2008 presidential candidates, including how, you know, there are various internet sites that suggest the Antichrist will be a man in his 40s, he will be of Muslim descent, people will flock to him and he will promise them false hope and world peace. He will not have any male descendants to pass on his name. And then he basically asked his volunteers whether they believed the claim that Obama was the Antichrist.
We're talking about white volunteers, correct?
That is correct.
And people who were asked to write about Tyrone Walker were more likely to believe the Antichrist charge than those who were asked to write about Brad.
And doing the reverse, priming them with a white prime, actually made them significantly less likely to buy the claim that Barack Obama was the Antichrist.
So why would priming somebody to think about a black person, increase the likelihood that you would believe that Obama is the Antichrist?
Most of us believe that we believe the things we do because we're either persuaded or unpersuaded by the information that comes to us. And what Brzezinski's experiment and a number of others suggest is really it's the terrain of our own minds that determines whether we buy certain claims or we do not. It turns out that if we can be prompted to think about some aspect of a person that makes that person different from us, we are instantly more likely to buy wildly inaccurate claims about that person.
In other words, if the terrain of our brains is primed to think about otherness, we're more likely to believe bad things about the other?
That's exactly right. And it doesn't make a difference, really, how that otherness is defined. You can define it according to race. You can define it according to political allegiances. In other words, if you ask Democrats to think about a Republican and then present them with a wildly inaccurate claim about Republicans, they're much more likely to believe that claim.
Okay, so bring us to this second group of researchers who tackled the question of otherness with some studies.
So what this other group of researchers basically did...
Who were they?
Well, a group of researchers that were led by Spee Kozloff and Jeff Greenberg at the University of Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 2008 election, Barack Obama was not the only candidate who had smears about him in general circulation. So did John McCain. The smears against John McCain, of course, were not race-related, but they were age-related, that McCain was mentally unfit to take office.
How did they prime people to think about age?
All that they asked people to do was to write down their own age. This was a group of relatively young volunteers, and so the researchers knew that they were essentially activating concepts in their mind that reminded the volunteers that they were youthful.
Anyone who is aware of these studies would conclude that in politics, exploiting the worst fears of the electorate works.
You don't really need a psychological study to prove that, you know, nasty mudslinging campaigns work. I think what the new research is showing is how precisely they work. One of the intriguing things, for example, that they show is that when people have very strong ideological beliefs, in other words, if they're very strongly supportive of Obama or McCain, they were much less likely to be persuaded by these unconscious biases. It's the people in the middle, in many ways, who were more persuadable. If you can trigger in these voters' minds a sense that there's something about this candidate that's different from you, those voters become much more likely to buy complete and blatant falsehoods about the candidate and then gravitate away from that candidate. And you can immediately see how insidious and subversive this is in an actual election campaign.
How do you counter it?
Our typical reaction is to counter those falsehoods with facts. When the smear about Barack Obama, for example, not being born in the United States, there have been hundreds of websites that have tried to present Obama's birth certificate as an argument against those smears. And it turns out that those factual refutations have virtually no impact. The things that turn out to be actually effective are the things that turn out to be effective in psychotherapy, which is you don't try and confront people's beliefs head on, but you try and confront them sideways. You try and approach them from a point of view of giving them an alternate way to think about their own feelings without deliberately or overtly denying the validity of those feelings. A very successful campaign ad that countered the belief that Obama was going to place the interests of African Americans ahead of the interests of whites was to have a white voter speaking directly into the camera and talking about how she had had a conversation with her mother about the time John Kennedy was running for president, and there were fears that he was going to place the interests of Catholics ahead of everyone else. But it turned out that that didn't happen, and the voter tells the camera, "I've decided I'm going to give Barack Obama a chance." What's more effective is to give people an alternate way to think about their mental terrain without directly challenging them.
Shankar, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on, Brooke.
Shankar Vedantam is a reporter for The Washington Post. He is also author of the book, The Hidden Brain, and he writes the Hidden Brain column for Slate.
The dark art of the political slur is now a commodity for export. Tyler Harbor is a political strategist and a vice president at Wilson Research Strategies. He's worked on presidential campaigns for John McCain, George H.W., and George W. Bush. He's also worked on a number of international campaigns in places such as Ukraine, Iceland, and Trinidad, to name but a few. Tyler, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
My sense is that the American way in the beginning of campaigns is a lot of soft focus, slow motion of a smiling politician, his sleeves rolled up, his jacket slung over his shoulder with his family on the steps of the church, followed quickly by attack ads in which his opponent is depicted in super slow motion, all in gray, looking like the spawn of Satan. First of all, am I right in my characterization? And secondly, how does that technique sell overseas?
Everyone hates negative political ads all over the globe. But the fact is that they work all over the globe. What the American consultants bring to the picture is focus. Focus on identifying and framing your candidate, and focus on identifying and framing your opponent. And with that comes both those positive ads, you know, the family, smiling candidate standing on the steps of the church, as well as those negative ads of portraying your opponent like a devil.
Well, congratulations, I guess.
You have to look at it like this. A lot of the times we are helping candidates win that are pro-West. So in addition to exporting a strategy that is a winning strategy, it gives us an opportunity to extend a non-formal way of supporting a pro-U.S. candidate.
In the United States, there is a long tradition among populist candidates of playing to the anger of the people. The Tea Party is a movement that is built on just that. Maybe Tea Partiers will get people coming out to the polls to throw the bums out. In less stable countries than the United States, is there not the risk that people will not go to the polls to throw the bums out? They will carry flaming torches to the parliament and actually get violent. What do you do to make sure that you're not too effective in your advertising?
That's the biggest fear, is creating violence. And we have to make sure that we kind of push it right up to the line, that we make them mad about the status quo, and that we don't incite that violence.
Have you seen campaigns where an American consultant does press a hot button that results in death and destruction?
You know, I think in Ukraine in 2005, after Yushchenko was poisoned and the Orange Revolution started, on the fringe of the Orange Revolution, I think that there was some violence. And I don't think anyone ultimately died. But I think that we walked it a little too far, perhaps at times. It's hard to point to because, you know, one message, by the time it penetrates, you know, there are a number of different things that affect the potential for violence. We just want to make sure that we don't push it to violence.
You mentioned Ukraine. This was in the parliamentary election in 2007, where you went after Viktor Yanukovych, who, to my way of thinking, is kind of a pro-Putin thug. But you didn't go after him personally, although he has a very long record of ripe material for attacking. You went after his party in general. And the ad, which is in Russian, sounded like this.
There is two kind of political fat cats, government types, sitting there talking back and forth about how much money they're making. And the camera kind of pans away and it shows this little tiny person standing among the money. And they look back and forth at each other and they're like, who is that? Oh, well, that's the little people of Ukraine. And they're like, oh, you know, we don't care about those little people. We're the government. And the little person in a very small voice tries to say, hey, but, you know, this is our country too. And the takeaway is, you know, Kovich's government is getting rich while the regular Ukrainians are suffering.
And so who's the president of Ukraine now?
The president of Ukraine was the same man that we that we tried to demonstrate.
Viktor Yanukovych. Corrupt.
That's exactly right.
The boss is back.
The boss is back.
As you well know, around the world, there is quite a bit of ambivalence about the United States. Some people hate us. And some people really hate us. And I'm curious whether the presence of an American political strategist ever itself becomes a bone of contention where some party that hires you is accused of being under the influence of the United States or the CIA or, you know, some sort of shadowy forces.
90%+ of our clients want us to come in secretly. In Trinidad earlier this year, the political consultants for the opposition were actually held in customs for 20-plus hours and then put them back on a plane to the United States. And that's not the first time it's happened. You want to make sure that you don't let anyone know before you go over there. And we go through great lengths to make sure that we stay secret.
You know, I must say, I don't even like most political advertising in our country. Are you taking the worst part of our democracy and sharing it with the nascent democracies of Europe and Asia and Africa, South America? Do you struggle with your conscience?
I don't struggle with my conscience because what wins elections is laying the groundwork and building a good strategy that identifies a persuadable population, persuades them, and then gets them to the polls in one capacity or the other. And negative advertising sometimes is part of that. It's a tool that we have to use to win a race.
War is hell, pass the ammunition.
Yeah, no political consultant is proud of negative advertising, you know, but in the long run, we're focusing on pointing out something about some candidate that the people should know before they make their choice.
All right, man. Thank you very, very much.
Hey, thanks, Bob.
Tyler Harbor is a political strategist and vice president and director of the Political and Public Affairs Division at Wilson Research Strategies.
Though the sums spent on campaign ads may be unprecedented and the media on which they appear may be new, their message is as old as politics. David Schwartz is chief curator for New York's Museum of the Moving Image, where he curated The Living Room Candidate, which traces campaign ads from the birth of television, starting with the 1952 campaign of Dwight Eisenhower. Thinking we'd end the hour by taking the long view, we asked Schwartz for a quick retrospective of that campaign, which set the template for so much that followed. For instance, in Eisenhower's ads, he talked to real people, just like candidates do now.
Of course, the people were filmed separately. They actually filmed them a day before asking the questions, and then they filmed Ike separately in a studio reading off of big cue cards.
Eisenhower answers America.
General? The Democrats are telling me I never had it so good.
Can that be true when America is billions in debt, when prices have doubled, when taxes break our backs, and we are still fighting in Korea? It's time for a change.
Everything goes back to Eisenhower because things really haven't changed a lot.
Which brings us to the biographical ad, which apparently is as old as campaigning itself.
In the beginning of a campaign, the candidate introduces themselves with an ad that sort of tells their story in 1 minute. So again, Eisenhower, he had an ad showing he was from the heartland of America.
The man from Abilene, out of the heartland of America, out of this small frame house in Abilene, Kansas.
And actually, if you look at the Obama campaign, he also did biographical ads.
I was raised by a single mom and my grandparents. We didn't have much money, but they taught me values straight from the Kansas heartland where they grew up.
Adlai Stevenson was the man from Libertyville. The Eisenhower campaign criticized that at first, and they said this is just made up, but he was actually from Libertyville. These are the feel-good ads. And then the mudslinging starts. Then all the attack ads begin.
Now, attack ads, that's a category that's so big that it's broken down into a variety of subcategories, one of which is the backfire ad, which I thought was a new phenomenon. But as you said, it goes back to Eisenhower.
Adlai Stevenson did backfire ads in 1956, and they took bits and pieces of the Eisenhower commercials from 52 and then showed how he didn't live up to his promise.
Another really enduring category is the scare ad. This is the one that uses ominous images to tie an opponent to a threat.
And that really was introduced in 1964. The most famous of all political ads was the Daisy Girl ad, which just juxtaposes two images. You have a little girl picking petals off of a daisy, this innocent little child, cut to mushroom cloud explosion.
This was a Johnson ad tying Goldwater to nuclear obliteration.
It's hard to do more of a vicious attack than that.
You know, very few people have the perspective you have because you can see every video ad of note throughout 50 years of campaigning. And I just wonder, are they becoming more outrageous?
The internet is changing things. I think now we're seeing ads that are taking more chances because the way that an ad works on the internet is if it's funny and provocative, it goes viral. For many years, the ads sort of stayed the same. They used the same techniques and the same messages. If you were attacking a Democrat, you would always say they want to raise your taxes or they're going to be weak on defense. And if you're attacking the Republicans, you say they don't care about the working class. They don't care about people. The motto, it's time for a change, we've been hearing since 1952. Ads do create a sense of expectation that always leads to disappointment. And that's why it's always time for a change.
Yeah. David, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
David Schwartz is the chief curator for New York's Museum of the Moving Image, where he curated The Living Room Candidate. Give me an unsung gem.
Well, Tony Schwartz, who made the Daisy Girl ad, did a hilarious ad in 1968 where you just see a TV set and you hear a man laughing. You know, he can't control himself. And then he sort of chokes at the end of the ad and coughs. And the image on screen just says, Agnew for Vice President. And I thought that was brilliant.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Sarah Abdurrahman, Nerida Brownlee, and Bonnie Watt, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was John Delore.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and our first violin. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by iContact, an email marketing firm dedicated to community empowerment. iContact offers email marketing service and solutions to qualified nonprofits. Learn more at iContact.com/giving. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.